creating cultural awareness and understanding. This is Culture Click. Culture Click is written and produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University.
On this episode of Culture Click, we bring you a talk entitled The New Frugality from American Public Media's Marketplace Money economics editor, Chris Farrell. Farrell will go over his pillars of proper finance and discuss how being frugal is about being green. His views will challenge you to put your core values at the center of saving, spending, and giving decisions because it's good for the planet as well as a person's finances. This talk is presented by Winona State University's Lyceum Series and is funded by the Winona State University Student Activities Fee and the Winona State University Foundation.
I just want to start by saying that our speaker tonight is known by many people in this room. At least his voice is. Some of us have been listening to him, to his personal advice for years. You probably know that Chris Farrell is an economics editor for Marketplace, American Public Media's nationally syndicated public radio programs on business and personal finance. He also writes regularly for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Bloomberg News, and is the author of numerous books, including The New Frugality and Unretirement. The Sustainable Futures Theme Committee at Winona State invited Chris tonight. And if you haven't read his books, you may be wondering, what's it got to do with a sustainable futures theme? But I can assure you that Chris Farrell is all about sustainable futures. He teaches us that a sustainable perspective on life saves money and does good. Plus, he was located in the region, so we expended less carbon to bring him here. He was affordable, so we were able to be wise stewards of our student and state money. And he delivers a message that brings value to all age groups. Whether you're focused on funding your college education or figuring out how you're going to save and make enough to live on in retirement, Chris has got something to give you. And I have to say, after spending the day with him, he's an incredibly good sport. He gave us all afternoon to be with his high school students so that young people would also have access to personal finance. So clearly, inviting Chris Farrell is a good community investment for Winona State. And his upbeat message can help each of us build our own sustainable future. Let's give Chris a really warm Winona welcome.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm really honored to be here. I think this is my third visit to Winona, and it's been great. And every time I come here, I learn more about the entrepreneurialism in the community, the civic culture. So what I'd like to do tonight is make some remarks about thinking about managing money over a lifetime. And in doing that, I want to put forward three concepts, and then what I consider the four pillars of managing money well. And then end on the 12 habits that I believe that if everybody follows, you never have to read another personal finance book again, you never have to read a personal finance article, that much of what we call managing money over a lifetime is developing some good habits. So to start off, there are three ideas, three concepts that I think are just important to keep in the back of your mind whenever we're talking about managing money or thinking about money. And the first is, life is uncertain. And it sounds so simplistic, but uncertainty is really important. You cannot get rid of uncertainty. And just sort of two quick examples. So we're back in 1900, and you're an intrepid British investor, and you have $10,000 to invest. And you're trying to think, so which emerging market should I put my money into? The United States or Argentina? Now, if you looked at the two economies, Argentina, they have a slight edge over the U.S. in 1900. So you put your $5,000 in Argentina, $5,000 in the U.S. A century later, you have millions upon millions from your U.S. investment, despite two world wars, Great Depression, inflation, all kinds of issues. And in Argentina, your money is worthless. Their stock market shut down for long periods of time. Wealth just vaporized. You lost various currencies. But at that time, in 1900, so the analogy I would draw today is think China, think India. So if you're making an investment over the next 50 years, which one do you think would be the better investment? You cannot get rid of that uncertainty. On a more personal note, when I graduated from college, I became a merchant seaman. And I worked for 4 years in engine rooms, mostly in tankers. And I started out as a wiper, which is a very good description because you clean the engine room and you clean the bathrooms of the seamen. And I loved it. In the modern merchant marine, you work 7 days a week, and you don't spend much time in port because time is money. So I saved a lot of money, and I took all my savings after 4 years, and I went to the London School of Economics. And I created a budget, had a good budget. And I went over with two friends, and we had a nice house, an apartment that we rented, and all the numbers worked. Everything worked. But that was a period of time when the dollar fell to its all-time low against the British pound because of rising inflation. And this budget was completely blown. Now, I made it, but I ended up with a diet of ramen noodles at the end. And I made it back to New York, and I would not exchange that experience. I would do it again, even if I knew the outcome. But you can't get rid of the uncertainty. Another key idea is that trade-offs matter. During the Quiz Bowl, they had one of the questions that they had to answer, and I think you all got it right, which was opportunity cost. Which is just a way of saying, you try to think through when you're doing one thing, or you're making one kind of investment, you can't be doing something else. So it's to try to think through systematically about the return that you're getting from investing your time and money into an activity compared to doing something else. And I think the classic example is going to college. Now, if you go to college, you have the cost of tuition and fees, and you also have the opportunity cost of not earning an income while you're doing your studies, while you're sitting in the classroom. And that opportunity cost is pretty significant. And so going to college is a belief that spending the time and getting your degree is going to pay off over a lifetime in terms of enlightenment, in terms of career opportunities, in terms of the kinds of jobs that are going to be available to you. And by the way, despite all the problems of the last couple of years, that remains the right choice, is to get a college education, is to embrace post-secondary education. And so congratulations for the students who are here, because it does pay off over a lifetime. And just as an aside, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York has been doing some wonderful work looking into the whole student loan issue. But they've also been looking at what's the rate of return on the college education. And they looked at a 4-year and a 2-year. And despite all the problems of the last couple of years, over the past decade, the rate of return, if you include the opportunity cost of not working, earning what a high school graduate would be earning, you look at the tuition, you look at the fees, taking on student loans, the rate of return on a college education is about 15%. And to put that into context, the rate of return on the stock market since 1950 has been about 5%, and the rate of return on bonds has been even less, about 3%. So congratulations for going to college. So opportunity cost, thinking through the trade-offs, that really matters. Now the other thing about personal finance is one of those times in life when it's all about you. It really is. It's all about you. It's not about averages. It's not about your friends. It's not about your neighbors. It's not about a colleague. It's all about you, because personal finance is, what are your goals? What are your desires? What are your dreams? What's the good life to you? Because all personal finance then is putting those tools. It's just putting the tools behind those goals, those dreams, those desires. So this is one of the times when your biography and your goals are not something to sort of say, well, you know, that doesn't really matter. It's your driver and your destination for thinking through personal finance. Now in this, I think there are four pillars for managing money well. So there are margin of safety, keep it simple, a sustainability ethic, and giving. Let's go through them. So a margin of safety. This is the bedrock concept in personal finance. And it's most famously associated with Benjamin Graham, his 1949 book, The Intelligent Investor. And he has been asked to distill the wisdom of investing into one phrase, three words. And he comes up with margin of safety. And a margin of safety is like when Warren Buffett, who was one of Benjamin Graham's acolytes, you build a road and you're going to have trucks going over it, 30,000, but you build it so it can handle 80,000. You have a margin of safety to protect yourself from the downside. And so a margin of safety is saving, right? I mean, that's the core concept in terms of having a margin of safety, because bad things happen to good people. And you have a medical emergency, you have to get on an airplane to visit your parents, whatever happens, a margin of safety is critical. But the thing about a margin of safety is that over time, as your savings grow, a margin of safety becomes your opportunity fund. And it becomes the fund that you tap because you want to get some additional education. There's a job opportunity over here that is intriguing. There's an investment opportunity here that you'd like to participate with. And so over time, just as you've heard, like risk and return are two sides of the same coin, well, safety and opportunity are two sides of the same coin. And that's the real power of a margin of safety, because you can't control the stock market. You can't control where the economy is going to go. You can't control if you're working for an employer and they decide they're no longer competitive in this division and they just close down that division. You can't control that. But if you have savings, you have a control over changing jobs, getting more education, having opportunity. And where I think this is going to become particularly important is, and when, retirement for young people is that's a far-off land, very far-off land. But we're going through a period of time where we're really rethinking the last third of life. And if you think about how we've had this discussion for years, you go to school, you work really hard, and then you retire, which means you don't work. And more what's happening is that people are realizing, you know what? I don't like this concept of not working. I want to continue to stay engaged. I want to continue to stay involved. And there's a variety of reasons behind it. I mean, part of it has to do with household economics. A lot of people, as they got older, haven't managed to save enough money. So continuing to work really helps out on the household finances. But we're also a better educated society, and we're also healthier than previous generations. And for many people, work has become part of their identity, who they are, their skills, their knowledge, their experience. And people are less and less willing to walk away from that. I was at a place, Vareto. It's outside of Phoenix. And so you have on one end of Phoenix, you have Sun City, which is the classic. You go there and you don't work, you play golf. And then Vareto is a multi-generational community that's being built on another section. And this one guy said something to me that has really stuck with me. He said, Chris, here's the thing. You've been working. You retire. You have a drink at 4:30 in the afternoon. It feels really good. You're not worried about losing your job, hiring somebody, company politics, whether it makes this phone call you have to make, you just relax. Then you have a drink at 3:30 in the afternoon, and you realize no one cares. Then you have a drink at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and you realize it's time to go back to work. And what we're seeing is not that people want to be doing the same job that they've been doing, but actually what they want to keep their skills. So they'll take a skill that they have, that they develop over the years, but move over to a different sector of the economy. So you go from the private sector to the nonprofit sector. You see a lot of people who go on, who have some skills, and they try and go teaching. Again, it's sort of that reassurance that comes from having your skills, but at the same time, it's kind of exciting to kind of be in a different part of the economy, being around different people, different missions, different values. And so I think this is really going to grow over time. And this is going to become much more of our discussion about what this last third of life is all about. Well, the thing is, at this moment in time, it's an experiment. It's the Baby Boomer Retirement Improv Act. And any of you who've done improv, You know, that can be really scary because you don't quite know what is it. But for the younger generation, by the time the younger generation is in their 50s and their 60s, it's going to be a very different story. And if you have savings, then you have so much more opportunity to pursue different goals, different dreams, different starting your own business, whatever it is you want to be doing in the last third of life. Because one of the things that has really struck me in doing interviews around the country is how much 20-somethings and 60-somethings, how much alike they are. You know, if you think about someone who's graduated from college, and I don't, looking around, I imagine many of you have had young people come to you, they graduate, and they're looking for advice, you know, about a career, about a job, and they're eager to start the career, they're eager to start the job, and that's, they do not want to be living in your basement. They want to have their own apartment, they want to be independent, but they also, there's also an idealism there. And those of us who are older support that idealism. It's important. Believe, yes, you want to make an income, but you want to do something that you're proud about. Well, now if you think about many of the conversations I've had with 60-somethings, it's the exact same conversation. It's about continuing to earn an income, but to do something that has meaning, something that you're giving back, something that makes a difference. And the only difference between the 60-somethings and the 20-somethings is that to the 60-something, time is short. And to the 20-something, time is infinity. So savings allows for choices to be made throughout a lifetime. It gives you flexibility. And I think it's going to become increasingly important as a population embraces work far longer than our sort of traditional image of what the elder years are all about. So the next thing I think is really critical is to keep it simple. And the more complicated your finances get, the more the strategies usually backfire, and the higher the fees, and the more costly they are. But the other part about keeping it simple is think about how complicated is the good life today. You know, I love my parents. They're great. So when I was growing up, and when it was time, we would have dinner, and then my parents would have a scotch and watch Walter Cronkite. And it was time for us to go up and do our homework. Now, when my kids were growing up, we did their homework with them when they were younger. And this is a widespread expectation. We're expected to be healthy and exercise, stay up on diet, stay up on technology, be engaged and vote politically, volunteer in our community. We work 20% more hours than we did in 1968, so our employers are demanding more of our time. The life, our lives are really full. And then on top of that, you're going to match wits with Wall Street traders. You're going to pretend that you're a broker. So you want to keep your finances as simple as possible so that you can go off and do the other things that matter to you. And keeping it simple, it's not just sort of embracing plain vanilla strategies or plain vanilla products, but it's also about not getting lost in the minutia, the details of personal finance, which is really easy to do. You know, your asset allocation, how much in stocks, how much in bonds, Roth versus traditional IRA, whole life insurance or term life insurance, all important questions. But when it comes to personal finance, you also want to step back every once in a while and say, okay, where am I going? What's my plan for the next 5 years? You know, because as Woody Allen said, life is not a dress rehearsal. And so you kind of want to step back, keep it simple, keep it to the basics. And this really came home to me when I met the hot dog man. So we were in Boulder, Colorado, and had a television show called Right on the Money. And we were doing a series of interviews there. And we took a break, and we were in downtown Boulder, Colorado. And there is this rakish-looking man, this white hair, he's kind of burly. And he was yelling, hot dogs, hot dogs, Pepsi, Pepsi, chips, chips. And he had this long, incredible line in front of his hot dog stand. So, got in line. And then I ended up talking to him. And I said, so what's the story here? He says, well, here's the thing, Chris, I'm Armenian. And grew up out near Wrigley Field. And outside of Wrigley Field, there were two of the corners were controlled by the Armenian hot dog men. And you know how young people want to be a fireman, they want to be a policeman. I wanted to be a hot dog man. because my parents, I would run from one to the other, back and forth, and get a hot dog from them. And then what he ended up working for Anheuser-Busch. He owned a piece of a distributorship, you know, raised a family, had a good career. And he retired at age 57, and he remembered about the hot dog stand. So he went, took some of his savings, bought a hot dog stand, and he just had a great time, made some money, but he was doing what he always wanted to do. And so then he just looked me right in the eye and said, okay, Chris, what's your hot dog stand? And I think that is part of this keeping it simple, about thinking through what is your hot dog stand. Now, the other part where I think there's just so much to be done, and it's exciting, is the rise of a sustainability ethic. And that one of the things so many people learned during the downturn, you know, looking around their house, their apartment, you know, why do I have this? Why did I borrow to do this? I knew it was important to me at some point, but is it really important to me? And so many people, you know, reaffirmed a lesson that we already know, that what we really value are experiences, creativity, spirituality. These are the things that really matter. And one of the things that the conversation has changed is that we come to realize that being green is frugal, and being frugal is green. And, you know, for a long time, being frugal, being thrifty, had kind of a bad image, because that meant you were the miserly. You were the one that never picked up the check, right? That was being frugal. No, that was being cheap. And, you know, but it's like the penny pincher, miserly. And there's this wonderful book. I like old books. And I picked up this one, Simon Wilson Strauss, 1920. It was a history of thrift in America. And he was the head of the Thrift Association of America. And he called it, you know, cheese pairing. And I have no idea what cheese pairing is, but it sounds really bad. But he had this wonderful definition about thrift. He said, no, that's really wrong. What thrift is judicious expenditures. We spend our money supporting the artists, the artisans, the professionals, the people who care in our community, the people who care and take care with their craft. It's judicious expenditures. And I think one of the things that has really changed is that a sustainability and a sustainability ethic has moved from the tributaries of society into the mainstream. And it's much more, and sustainability is one of those amorphous terms, but it's about global climate change, it's about the environment, it's about the health of our local communities, about the health of the civic culture, it's about the health of your local entrepreneurs. That's a very, I think, a very broad definition. And one of the things that has become incredibly important about sustainability ethic is that when I was writing my book, The New Frugality, I went back and looked at the previous post-World War II recessions. And it's really striking. It's kind of fun because you have, a lot of you at the university here will have access to archives. And you'll go back, and in the recession, there'll be all these articles about people saying, I learned my lesson. I'm going to be thrifty. But what they were saying is, I'm going to be cheap. I'm going to go to Costco, and I'm going to buy a big box of tuna fish. And I'm going to feed my family that tuna fish until they run out the door. Then I'm going to go back to Costco, and I'm going to buy a big bag of brown white rice. Well, that's not how anybody wants to live. And so as times got better, you know, you kind of toss, you know, saving the tin foil and all the other things. And also the economy was a lot stronger, and so a lot of that went good. But we really hit into a bad circumstance more recently. We took on a lot more debt, and household income didn't grow. But the thing about, the other thing why people went ahead and borrowed, and this came from a conversation with my mother, was realizing that borrowing is an optimistic act. I mean, if you think about it, those of you who bought a house, took out a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage, at some fundamental level, you believe that over the next 30 years, I'm going to be employed, that I'm going to be able to pay this mortgage. So I was talking with my mom, and it was about the book, and I wanted to learn more about, they had moved to Levittown. So this is after World War II, and Levittown is the famous first post-World War II suburb. And my parents were living first on Long Island in the Chrysler Mansion, and they lived on the top floor, and my dad had to kneel to shave, because the bathroom had a very low ceiling. And then they moved to an apartment in Queens, owned by the Trump family. And you can not only hear next door, but you could also hear above you and you could hear below you. And then Levittown, and it had two bedrooms, and it had radiant heat, and it had a refrigerator, and it was life was good. This is 1948. And then my mom said an aside, she goes, and you know, your grandfather didn't talk to your father for years after that. Now, besides the fact that probably made my dad really happy, I was kind of curious, why not? And he said, well, your grandfather worked for Anaconda Copper in Yonkers, New York, and he was one of 60 bookkeepers. And Anaconda Copper, during the Great Depression, fired basically one bookkeeper after another, and he was the only one to survive the Great Depression. But he watched 59 people lose their jobs. And then he had bought, in Yonkers, he had bought a home. And at that time, the only way you could buy a home, he bought it in the 1920s, the only way you could really buy a home for the average person was to buy what's called an interest-only mortgage, which, by the way, is proof positive that it only takes 80 years for a really bad idea to come back. And the thing about an interest-only mortgage is that it works so long as home prices are appreciating. It no longer works when home prices depreciate. And an extended Irish Catholic family had moved into this home, and an extended Irish Catholic family had to leave the home and move into a two-bedroom apartment in Yonkers. And so he never borrowed again. And as a total aside, even though the home had been foreclosed, he did end up paying off the bank completely over the years, everything that he owed them, even though he never had to pay them back. But he never borrowed again. And so he was absolutely convinced that my father was ruining his family. He was guaranteeing that this family was going to financial perdition. So I said to my mom, I said, why did you borrow? And they borrowed a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. I said, why did you borrow? She said, you know, Chris, we just believed the world was going to be a better place. We had kids, and we borrowed to own homes, and it was just going to work out. We fundamentally believed it. And if you think about borrowing, it's a really optimistic act. Now, the thing is, we've also learned that borrowing really, we had a really harsh lesson that there's the downside to borrowing. And the thing about sustainability is that I believe sustainability, and embrace the sustainability ethic, is fundamentally an optimistic act. We don't really know whether all these things that we're embracing, to try to take greater account of our local communities, to try and take account of the environment, you know, to try and lower our footprint, we don't really know how big an impact they're going to have. We know that a lot of things that we do as individuals have a relatively small impact, but it can also change the way society works, could change, have much bigger impact as it works its way through society. But sustainability is a fundamentally optimistic act, and sustainability has nothing to do with being cheap. It has to do with being a conservative consumer. It has to do with being more thoughtful about what you're doing and what you're spending your money on, but fundamentally, it's an optimistic act. And I think that's one of the reasons why a sustainability ethic over time is going to have a very powerful impact on how we manage and think about our money. And the fourth pillar, the final pillar, is putting giving or generosity at the core of money management. Now, over the course of a lifetime, for most people, you are saving, you know, the biggest chunk of money is probably going to be their retirement savings plan, a 401k or a 403b. And how much they give is probably going to be relatively small compared to that. But the reason why I think giving is so important in managing money is think about the questions you ask yourself when you are giving money. It's about what matters to me. What kind of legacy do I want to leave? Where do I want to help make the world a better place? And so those are the really important questions. So why not ask the same questions when you're spending and when you're saving? And so if you put giving at the core of the way you think about money, I think it has a great influence on how you manage your money, where you invest your money, what you do with your money. And it also separates money from, you know, money has a hold on many of us. And in most periods, or most of us at some point in our lives, we go through a period of life where money can have a really big hold on us. And the thing about giving and being generous is that it breaks that hold that money can have. So if you take giving and sustainability and keep it simple, and a margin of safety, that these, I think, will really hold up well over the course of a lifetime. And then I think there are like 12 habits. I'm calling them habits. And I adopted this from, there's a professor at the University of Chicago, Harold Pollack. And he gives a pretty funny story where he was giving an interview and he kind of made a smart aleck remark about, you know, all you need to know about investing, you can put on an index card. And someone wrote to him and said, do it. And he did it. And he put it on the internet, and it was pretty good. And then I modified it slightly. And so here are the 12 habits that I think will hold you up well in the course of a lifetime. So I mentioned margin of safety, keep it simple. And then green is frugal. Frugal is green, and generosity or giving, key to managing money well. Save 20% as a goal. Now this one, I usually get a lot of pushback on, 20%. But if you think about it, if you're participating in your retirement savings plan at work or setting one up on your own, that's 10% right there, if you're going to the max. So it's another 10% above that. Now 20% is a goal. And for people graduating from college and just starting out, okay, you can't even come close to that. But what you can do is automate your savings and just have a little bit of money go into a savings account. Nothing has to be anything fancy. Just start it out from the beginning. And then as you become more comfortable in your career, more comfortable in your jobs, or earning more income, you can start raising that. But again, 20% is a goal. But the most important thing is that you automate the savings in that it just grows over time. And it grows slowly at first and surprisingly fast later. Pay your credit card balance off in full every month. There was a period of time when personal finance and credit card debt were synonymous. They're basically the same thing. And the reason why you want to pay, you know, a credit card is an incredible technology, and it's really convenient. But it's also a signal if you're not paying it off in full at the end of the month, it's also a good signal that you're living above your means. And it's a pretty high interest rate, and it's also a bad habit to get into. So you want to pay it off whenever you can. You're going to face this more and more as you get older and you get jobs that have a retirement savings plan, you start thinking more about retirement savings plan. I would buy well-diversified, broad-based index funds. And the big thing about index funds, so you match the market, the Standard & Poor's 500, the total market index. The thing, the real power of an index fund comes in, or a big part of the power comes in, it has very low fees. So, you know, the average fee for an actively managed mutual fund where you're hiring someone who's trying to guess where the market's going next, and they're buying and selling stocks or bonds, and they have an army of researchers and lots of analysts, that averages out about 1%. And then if you look at your broad-based index fund, it's right now around 10 basis points, 11 basis points, and the basis points, 1/100th of 1%. And the thing is, what the evidence is overwhelming, that 80% of all actively managed mutual funds underperform their indexes. And a big part of it has to do with the fees. The other part of it is, the capital markets is the most competitive business in the world, with lots of really smart people and lots of really dumb people trying to make money. And so, you know, instead of trying to play that game, if you just match the market, you're going to do well over a lifetime. Stick with high-quality investments. And that's just across the board, whether it's stocks, it's bonds, insurance, working with an institution that has a good balance sheet. You want to stick with high-quality investments. There's always that lure of going into the riskier stuff. But there's a reason why it's called riskier stuff. And so unless you're really living it, just stick with the high-quality investments. This, to me, is the most important, is you want to invest in skills for the kinds of career or careers that you want. And more, I think what we're going to see is a population. I think it's going to be particularly true for the millennials. It's somewhat true for the boomers. But that more and more people are going to go back to school to pick up additional education, get a certificate, get some kind of credential, and do it much more of a lifetime. And that investment in your education and skills is incredibly important. When it comes to borrowing, it's okay to borrow for an investment. You know, borrow to buy a home, borrow to invest in a college education. You don't want to borrow too much. You want to be cautious with how much you borrow. You want to be conservative about how much you're borrowing. But, you know, borrowing by itself is not bad. But there is also bad borrowing and good borrowing. And it's not necessarily breaks down the way we think. I have a friend and known him for years. And so I first met him in 1986. So I know at least since then, since 1986 till now, he has paid for a credit card for everything. He buys a stick of gum on his credit card. Now the thing is, over this period of time, he has never once carried any debt on his credit card. He pays it off in full. But he has two children, they're scattered around the country, and he accumulates points. And so she uses a credit card very smart. Interviewing a person during the downturn, a good couple, and they borrowed way too much to own a home, and they went into foreclosure. So it's not necessarily what you're doing, it's how you approach your debt, how you manage your debt. But as a general perspective, borrowing to invest in an investment that pays off is far more sensible than borrowing to consume something. You also want to diversify, because if you think about diversification, it's about spreading your risk. And, you know, it's always unexpected stuff is happening. I mean, how many of you really thought, if you put yourself back, oh, let's go back 6 months, how many of you really thought that you would see the price of oil breaking $50 a barrel? I mean, it just wasn't there. Or if we were back we're back in 2004, 2005, and I told you that the Federal Reserve was going to do quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3. And the Federal Reserve is going to be buying all these bonds, and the Federal Reserve balance sheet was just going to explode. And you would say, well, inflation is going to go to triple-digit numbers. But we barely have inflation today. So diversification is a way to protect yourself against the uncertainty, to protect yourself against what may or may not happen. And there's a wonderful passage in Shakespeare where he talks about, and Antonio, his ships are at sea, and he's asked, aren't you worried about his ships? He says, no, because I've got to have it spread. My cargo is spread among a number of different ships. And the first mention that I've been able to find, or scholars have been able to find, of the mention of diversification is in the Talmud, where you divide your assets in third, real estate, money, I believe the other one was cattle. We have that concept of diversification, which I think is incredibly important over a lifetime. So these are the kinds of habits that I believe pay off. You're not going to dazzle anybody. They're not going to invite you to go on CNBC. Kramer's not going to laud you or do anything with you. However, what you'll be able to do is concentrate a lot more on the things that matter to you, because money then is a tool, and it helps you accomplish your goals. So that's the framework that I have for thinking about money.
I think we'll leave it there. We're going to let Chris sit down because he's got some books to sign. But ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Chris Farrell.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thanks again to Chris Farrell for his presentation on The New Frugality. More information on Chris can be found at www.chrisfarrell, that's F-A-R-R-E-L-L, blog.com. Another thank you goes out to the Winona State University Foundation for funding Farrell's discussion as part of the Lyceum series. I'm Terry Tensett, and you've been listening to Culture Click.
Creating cultural awareness and understanding. You've been listening to Culture Click. Support for Culture Click is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Culture Click is produced by KQAL-FM on the campus of Winona State University. For more information, look us up on the web at kqal.org. And thanks for listening to Culture Click.